This is Packer and Durham on ACCN and SiriusXM Channel 371.
We discussed a lot of ACC basketball last night. We had four conference games on the men's side, three more tonight. The ladies take center stage tomorrow, which will be terrific. Again, six ACC women's teams ranked in the top 20. Pretty impressive. The men's side, it's all about Duke. Everybody's chasing the Blue Devils. And, Wes, you had a chance to see them last night. A little rusty after the COVID pause. But at the end of the day, Duke does what they do best, and that is win.
Yeah, pair of double-doubles last night. It was interesting. We talked at the top of the broadcast last night about Mark Williams kind of finding his rhythm as a player, not just at the – in terms of rebounding perspective, but also offensively as well last night. So I thought his double-double came at a pretty good time. We talked about Georgia Tech being undermanned inside. That really opened the door for Williams and Bancaro. Now, Saturday, that will not be the case when Miami visits, because the Canes can throw some bodies at Bancaro and also Williams as well. That'll challenge Duke in a different way. The guy that caught my eye last night, though, Pack, was A.J. Griffin. He's going to be a problem at the end of the year. I mean, he's a talented guy, period. But he is going to be a problem. I think he's a really difficult matchup. Just athleticism all over the place. But great basketball instincts last night. I was really impressed with the minutes he played last night at really both ends of the floor for the Blue Devils. So throw another guy in there to join Wendell Moore, Bancaro, Keels, Roach. I mean, the list goes on and on, doesn't it, when it comes to the Blue Devils? I mean, Joey Baker came in last night, banged down a three, and next thing you know, here comes another guy off the bench trying to help him out as well.
But Griffin gives Coach K the ability to go large, small, and gives him so much more diversity in terms of the kind of lineup he can put on the floor, which becomes a matchup issue for everybody in this league. And nobody knows that better, though, than our next guest, because he's back a couple of weeks ago. Luke Hancock, that means it's time for hoops. Luke, first of all, Happy New Year. Always good having you on the show. What did you learn last night of the four ACC games? Anything jump out at you where you went, fascinating, didn't see that coming? Anything jump out at you?
You guys know you're not learning anything right now in the ACC. This is the toughest time to judge anything besides Duke is playing so incredibly well. I think what you guys were just talking about, it's kind of scary to think about. Duke's going to have another piece emerge that helps them out on the defensive end. He's knocking down shots. We know about how athletic A.J. Griffin is. That is some scary stuff. But in terms of last night, you know, I think you're losing any confidence or any certainty. You know, NC State is one of those teams that can play really well one night and then turn around and just not be there the next. I think they're a tough team to figure out. Like we said, Duke done what they've done all year. Wake Forest is a team where, you know, in that first game in the ACC, wow, did they put a hurting on Virginia Tech. Then they drop two games and come back with a really good Florida State win. Home court advantage hasn't seemed to mean as much just yet. And then the last game of the night, when you talk about Virginia, you want certainty. They have none for you. You know, is this going to be a Tony Bennett team that's the best defensive team in the country, or is this going to be a team that tries to play like last year and is an offensive juggernaut? They're not giving you any certainty either.
All right, so we're not going to buy in anything. Let's see, can we take out a loan on some people? Okay, if we're not going to go completely invest here, look at us talking to the financial guy, Tupac. All right, so let's scale here a little bit, Hancock. Let me give you a concern. I've got a concern about Virginia Tech, and I know they're coming off the pause last night, and I know they didn't shoot it very well. Neither did Florida State, who was coming off a pause, and neither did Duke coming off a pause. But I'm about one or two away from where I thought Kevin Aluma could be a potential player of the year in the league this year. I'm slightly concerned about Virginia Tech. Do you share my concern there?
Yeah, absolutely I do. And I actually thought Kevin Aluma was going to be the player of the year in the conference this year. I was one of those dummies that said, this is Virginia Tech's time. I saw what Mike Young has done through his first years, and just the trajectory is incredible. And even though they've played well this year, he hasn't made that same distance jump to be just elite this year like I thought he would. And I think against NC State is really telling, especially just along the lines of Kevin Aluma and his production. The front court for Virginia Tech should have dominated NC State last night. I personally, I love what Kevin Keats is doing. They've got some stuff behind them recently with FBI mm-hmm. stuff. I mean, watch out for Kevin Keats in the next few years, especially with Terquavion Smith and with Darion Sebron. They are really, really good, especially in that backcourt. But where they're thin, we've talked about Manny Bates 100 times, right? And so I just got to imagine that NC State would be a team that's going to be able to compete with the best teams in this league. But they don't have that guy. The front court isn't there. So I would have expected Virginia Tech to go out and take advantage of that. Justin Mutz and Keve Aluma are a great tandem. They pass well together, a little inside-outside game. And, you know, you have Dewana, who's holding it down, trying to keep things together. You're not going to get Manny Bates back, but he's got a lot of development to do. So, you know, NC State's backcourt was able to dominate the game. They were really good on the defensive end. And there is a blueprint to beating Virginia Tech, to your point, Wes. If you are really physical with them, you make them start their offense near half court. In particular, you go right at Storm Murphy over and over again. It really makes it difficult for them to get in and run those great sets that Mike Young runs. And I think early on, Memphis was that team for me that skill-wise and having some veteran players, I thought Virginia Tech would have been able to beat Memphis up. But Alex Lomax, specifically on Storm Murphy in some of these early tournaments, he was able to kind of show you if you're ultra physical, if you beat them up, you run them off the three-point line, Virginia Tech is not the same team. And like I said before, I'm admitting fault. I'm admitting that I'm wrong because I chose Virginia Tech and Keve Aluma to make that great run and be first or second in the league.
Luke, tonight, Syracuse is at Miami. Canes have been a pleasant surprise. Of course, they've been at home, which is, again, it is what it is, but they've taken care of business. We've talked about home court advantage has been kind of iffy so far in the league. Syracuse, to me, has been somewhat of a disappointment because I had big expectations for them. They let a home game get away from them against Virginia where the Hoos put over 70 on them. Syracuse takes it on the road. They've won at Florida State. Go figure. Now they go to Miami. Your take on both of those teams, I know it's still early, but, I mean, they've both been kind of surprising in different ways, haven't they?
They really have. You know, Syracuse is that team for me. I just – if they had one more win, if we could go back and circle that Georgetown game, we'd be talking about Syracuse in such a different way. I think this is a team who has to find a way to make their defense more impactful. I played against that 2-3 zone. I know how uncomfortable it is to catch the basketball at that free throw line spot that everybody talks about. This is how you beat Syracuse zone. They're constantly picking at you. They're constantly deflecting passes. They're making you so uncomfortable at that free throw line, or that's what we've known from the 2-3 zone forever. You know, I played against Michael Carter Williams, who was 6'6" at that point guard spot. That's a little different than Joe G up top, you know, and I think they have a lot of guys who fill the same role for Syracuse. There are a lot of guys who, when they pull up for a jump shot, you're like, man, that thing is going in. They got a lot of guys who you scratch your head when they miss it, but they don't have a lot of creators off the bounce for the offensive end. So they end up shooting a lot of tough shots. Now, their offense is simplified, and you get Buddy Boeheim in the right spots. He's a bucket. That's just how it is. But as far as being able to break people down off the dribble and create for others, they don't really have that guy. So you got to shoot it really well if you're Syracuse, and I think if they want to make a jump to get in that second grouping, the 2-3 zone has got to be more impactful. And on the other side of that, you know, Miami, it's about consistency. Are you going to bring it every single night? Because, you know, you get to a hot start in this league, you're sitting at 3-0, you got to be feeling great. But this game right here, this Syracuse game, is one you really need to win if you're Miami and you want to keep on with this just positive momentum. Both these teams, I think, are a little lax on the rebounding side. Miami in particular, you're dealing with bigs that are, you know, 6'10", that weigh as much as I do. You know, I played the 2 and the 3 spot at Louisville, and Anthony Walker and Dan Gak are my size guys in terms of weight. So they have some deficiencies in the front court, but when, you know, you can't go wrong when you have Isaiah Wong. You guys mentioned some efficiency numbers earlier. I thought he would have been near the top of that list with Malik Williams. You know, he's the guy for Miami, and I love what Cam Augusti's doing. They've got some other pieces they've brought in, like Charlie Moore. But ultimately, you know, I've played for Coach Larrañaga. I know it's defense first. I know if you don't do the defensive principles, you're not going to be able to have that fun on the offensive end. So I think they're a little bit of a work in progress, but it's about consistency, and you have to find a way to win a game like this tonight if you're Miami.
You know, but here's the thing, Luke, about Miami. It feels like they're kind of coming back into form, and Pack has said this because they're not injured, right? I mean, that's the thing. He's got his full roster here. And I agree with you about Charlie Moore, who might be old as me in terms of all the basketball and all the places he's been. But with Wong and McGusty, and this may be the year, Pac, you help me. This may be the year where if you have two guys like Isaiah Wong and Cam McGusty, if you just get the other guys to play complimentary basketball, it might carry you a while. I mean, because we don't have that star of stars type ACC this year. We have good, and we may have one great one. So, I see Miami, if they can just stay healthy, I think Miami's in this thing for the long run, regardless of what happens tonight.
Well, we know, you know, a couple things, right? Number one, if you have a great backcourt, or in particular one of those guys who is elite with the ball in his hands like Isaiah Wong, and then you give him a backcourt running mate like Cam McGusty, those guys are veterans. You mentioned how old these guys are, how many battles they've been through. That is an incredibly powerful thing in college basketball, having those veteran guards. And then number two, you think about the complementary pieces like Jordan Miller for a while, the transfer from George Mason. I mean, he was shooting some of the highest percentages in the league from beyond the arc. You know, they've got some other pieces to the puzzle there. It's amazing what just having a roster will do for Jim Larrañaga. I talked about this with Carlos Boozer on Nothing But Net kind of all year last year, that Chris Likes needed to come back and be that dominant ACC scorer that he was. And Earl Timberlake, who was this big stocky guard that never really got into a rhythm there, was going to need to step up. And even Matt Cross, like, you think about the turnover that Coach Larrañaga's had and what the transfer portal has done, bringing in these pieces, but it has to be the right ones. You know, like Wake Forest, he put together the right ones. And speaking about quality guards that can lead your team, Alondez Williams, Isaiah Wong, those guys, Jared West, those are the ones that are making, you know, decent teams in the middle look a lot better right now. And I think schedules have helped out with those teams getting a hot start. But, you know, you got to take advantage when you can.
Well, the only concern I have about Miami, and I'll close the thought on this, is that Miami's been out-rebounded by 11 a game in the three ACC games they've played. I mean, that you can't – Pac, you know this. That's not going to survive. You give up minus 11 on the glass in three ACC games on average, you're not gonna win many games. I mean, down the road, that comes back to bite you a little bit.
If you go back to look at their losses too, it's just bad matchups where you go against a dominant, tough rebounding front court. Again, I go back to, is Anthony Walker and Dan Gatt going to be the guys that can be physical enough, can rebound enough, can defend enough? You know, I actually, funny you mention it along those lines, I talked to Jim Larrañaga and Chris Caputo at the beginning of the season before we even got going, and they talked about, we're going to mix up our style a little bit. We're thinking about changing our defense. And they were actually asking about our 2-3 matchup zone we used to play at Louisville, where Rick would kind of move us in and out of a zone and a man-to-man just to try and speed you up, keep you in front, you know, force the other team to take some tough twos when you can get them off the three-point line. Yeah, I think all those things mean, hey, we don't necessarily feel comfortable with our bigs being able to compete against Carolinas or Dukes or what we've seen from Florida State in years past. And it is what it is. They got to find ways to rebound, but I think it's going to be by committee at this point because, you know, like I said, I'm a skinny, tall dude, and those don't rebound well in the ACC. They're going to need some extra help.
Luke, we have emphasized so much on this show in the last week or two, making the transition to hoops, trying to figure out which ACC team this side of Durham can start piecing together wins and going week to week without losing. Who can start separating themselves from teams 2 through 15 in this league? Tonight in South Bend, you have North Carolina and Notre Dame. The Heels are looking to go 3-0 on the road. Let me emphasize that, on the road. Notre Dame, even though they've given you spurts of good and bad, you know they can be dangerous when they make threes. It just feels like this is one of those kind of games. Who can start building some momentum? Because I think the winner of this game wakes up tomorrow morning going, guess what? That team could be us.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I will say I have been to South Bend in one of these big games where Notre Dame feels like they need a win, and it is an incredibly tough place to play. We went 5 overtimes, and the luck of the Irish got us. You saw what they did at Kentucky early on this year. They've just found a way, even having kind of a thinner front court going against some of these powerhouse rebounding teams, to make you play a way you don't want to. And I thought Mike Bray's execution in that Kentucky game, and I use those comparisons, I think athletically they kind of line up a little bit, but the way he waited to double late on Oscar Shigwe, the way they took away certain shooters, the way they just kept you in front and just kind of packed it in and made you take some, again, tough twos. His strategy was perfect in that game. There are certain guys for Carolina you cannot let just step up to the three-point line and knock down shots. You obviously need to keep them out of transition, and you have to rebound the ball against Carolina. But they checked a lot of those boxes against Kentucky. So I would imagine Notre Dame's going to have that confidence. I don't know if they have LaPhonso Ellis coming in. I would honor that guy in the Ring of Honor every week if I got a win like that against Kentucky. But he needs to be giving pregame speeches or something. So I don't know. But I agree with you about momentum coming out of this game.
Okay, I'll add this. It feels like somebody other than Bacot or Caleb Love's going to have a big game for Carolina to win tonight. How's that, Luke? Because Bray's going to defend at least those two. Yeah.
I like that. I mean, you know, these coaches, especially guys like Mike Bray, who have been around for that long and have won in big environments like that, he's not going to go out like a punk, man. He's going to have a game plan. He's going to make adjustments. And Notre Dame is one of those teams. Can you imagine a hungrier group of guys? They have not made the NCAA tournament the entire time they've been there. They're going to go down with, you know, 1,000-point scorers and great rebounders and all these accolades, and really not much to show for it unless they get things going. And you got to imagine, you know, social media in your face 24/7 and coaches and fans, they hear that. They hear those rumblings. And so I'd imagine Notre Dame will be very ready to play in this one here and surprise you just like they did against Kentucky.
Luke, it's January the 5th. You're going to be allowed to change your mind 100 times between now and the ACC tournament. We would all assume, and probably rightfully so, that Duke's the best team in the league. That's nothing surprising. But who do you think is the second best team right now on January the 5th in the league?
I've been asked this question over the last few weeks, and to your credit, it has changed every week. I like the ACC accounting where I can just have to get it right for this week. But to me, I am going to choose Louisville this week. I think their schedule sets up for them to make a little run here over the next six or seven games. They've got Pitt twice and Boston College once. But it's about, again, consistency. Who's going to step up and answer the call each and every game? It's got to feel good if you're Miami, if you're Louisville, to be looking down undefeated in conference at these other places. But I think you're starting to see this group come together. I think as Malik Williams gets healthier, you see how much of a just centerpiece he is to everything they want to do on both ends of the floor. Jared West has been great on the defensive end and as a leader for this group. So, you know, I don't want them to be a team that has to say, if we shoot it well, we're going to win. If not, we're going to lose. And I thought that was how they were trending early on this season. And now I feel like they've started to develop an identity. We're going to be a great defensive team. And if we can get open shots and knock them down, we're going to be really, really good. If we have to grind our way through a game the way they did against Georgia Tech, they can win that way as well. And I had the red alert, man. I was really worried after that WKU game. They shot 7 free throws. They got pushed around. They didn't knock down shots. They weren't emotionally ready for that game or focused. And I was really worried. And I think the last few games, and again, when you're undefeated in conference, I know it's only January 5th, but that makes you feel really good. So I think Noah and Matt Cross knocking down shots has helped change this team a little bit. It's given them a little confidence. And if you like other teams, and you guys have mentioned the ones that, you know, trajectory looks good, and now that you have guys playing the right way, it makes sense. But if Jalen Withers comes along, you know, made the all freshman team last year, is playing different position this year, and he's still trying to embrace and find his way here. If he gets going, that could be a huge catalyst for Louisville to go from playing really good to, you know, maybe not competing with Duke, but they'll be the second best team in the league.
All right. Two quick things here before we shut it down. One, they're going to retire Russ Smith's jersey on January 22nd. So you'll have one of your teammates up there in the rafters of the Yum Center with you. I mean, you're on that banner with the MOP of the Final Four. Russ Smith will be up there with Unseld, Daryl Griffith, all those cats, Charlie Tyree, the whole nine yards. So I know you're excited about that. Number two, we saw you sneak the Packer and Durham mug on the set there a minute ago, the coffee mug. And good to see that you're keeping it out of the dishwasher so it's not part of the Czechoslovakian collection where the letters go wiping off and it looks like some Eastern Bloc warm-up suit from the 76 games in Montreal. So you get points for that too, by the way. Oh, look, CPAC, more endorsement for the show. by Hancock.
Let me tell you something.
Hand-washing at all times.
That's exactly right. And consider that thing valuable because there's only like 11 of them in the entire civilized world. And we're still trying to get our hands on them. It's crazy.
So getting to if something goes wrong. I gotcha. Yeah, just in terms of Russ Smith, man, I'm so excited for him. You know, he was obviously a great player at Louisville and All-American, but what an incredible person. I know he's trying to get back to playing. He's been off for a long time, so he just got a G League invite. I'm excited to see what he can do. I think he had 65 points in the last G League season that he played in a game. There's no scorer like Russ Smith. I'll tell you another Smith that I've compared him to actually this year, because I haven't seen a player in college basketball since Russ Smith that just plays like he does. But same last name, Turquavion from NC State. Ooh. Just has this kind of confidence and unorthodox game. And it just like when you have that focus to score and every time you catch the basketball, you know, some coaches, they'll tell you to run a play where you kick it back or you reverse the basketball. Anytime Russ Smith or Turquavion Smith catches the basketball, they are thinking one thing: how do I get the ball in the basket? And so for Russ Smith to get his jersey retired, I'm so very excited for him. He wrote me a nice little note on Twitter talking about our team, and just the run we had was incredible. So I'm so excited for him. And I owe you guys for getting me this swaggy Packer and Durham mug here. I'm going to try and get you guys a little Rusticulous bourbon. He just came out with his bourbon. I know he's got four bottles that he just released. So we're going to work on that for you guys. I think it's called Mr. and Miss, and it's cool.
Advantage Packer and Durham. That is a win for us. I can guarantee you. Bourbon versus a mug. We win. And remember this. You guys are showcasing your mugs. Let me just give you this one. Refill with bourbon. That's it right there.
There you go.
The Packer and Durham Podcast. Here's Mark Packer and Wes Durham.
Packer and Durham on a Wednesday. Many thanks to Luke Hancock. It's Insight to ACC Hoops. Three games going on tonight. Pitt, Louisville, Syracuse, Miami, North Carolina on the road at Notre Dame. Looking for separation. Who can take care of business? We'll see what happens on that front.
Interesting, Luke talked about defense, right? Especially as it relates to Syracuse and the zone. Boy, he's right about Michael Carter Williams. That guy was like a predator at the top of that zone.
Spider-Man. Yep. Long and man, it just disrupted everything. And that's been the issue for Syracuse. He was spot on for the defense and says, you know what? They've got to be more efficient on that end. They've got shooters, but Wes, eventually that zone's got to mess you up. And if you're not getting the job done, man, people get easy looks against you.
Yeah, I was sitting here looking at some of the defensive numbers in the ACC. Scoring defense-wise, there are five teams that went into play last night holding opponents under 65 points a game, two of them holding opponents under 60. That was Virginia and Virginia Tech. But sometimes you got to go look at some of these other categories, not just scoring. The field goal percentage defense, Virginia's in there, and so is Louisville and Clemson. In the top three, they were holding opponents to under 40%. Now, that speaks maybe more to your schedule, non-conference opponents, whatever. Virginia, Louisville, and North Carolina were holding opponents. In fact, there were six teams holding opponents to under 32% from three. I think we're going to need a little bit more of a sample size from conference play to kind of sort out, you know, kind of who's what, if you will, on that particular end of the floor. But Syracuse has got to get it cleaned up. There's no question about that. I mean, opponents are shooting 42% from the floor going into the week. Even Miami opponents are shooting 46%, which is kind of weird, right? I mean, you're 3-0, you're undefeated in the league, and yet you're giving up almost 47% from the floor. But the Orange, clearly an adjusted defensive efficiency, as you see on the screen, 188th. That doesn't seem anywhere near the ballpark they should be playing in.
I don't think anybody anticipated that. Now, granted, the injury standpoint may have a little impact on that defensive end too, especially inside. But, Wes, that number must improve for Syracuse if you're going to become an NCAA tournament team. We know you got shooters and all that stuff, and we know how that game gets played too. When you're making shots, you got a chance. But if you don't, man, you better be getting it done on the defensive end. Syracuse to date has not done a very good job in that department.
Yeah, and And Pack, you mentioned the injury situation. Baroma Sidibe has not played except for a couple of ball games. Did not make it on the floor the other night against Virginia. We'll see if he plays. And even the minutes he has played have been very limited at the back end of non-conference games. Brown and Cornell, respectively. If they had him, it would be huge. But Jesse Edwards, Anselm, those guys, they're going to have to carry the water, at least for the time being, in terms of the post. And Syracuse, now, as much as we spend time talking about defense, they're going to have to make shots. And the other night, you and I saw this in the Virginia game. They had the ball and opportunities to take the lead, grab control of the ball game if they executed at the offensive end of the floor. The issue with defense means the premium on the offense becomes that much more significant, right?
Right.
I mean, if you can't stop anybody, you're going to have to hit shots. That's what we talked about with Carolina. Remember? November, December, early on, before they got to Michigan, the ACC Big Ten Challenge, and kind of started rounding into some sort of playing personality at that end of the floor. By the way, that'll be challenged tonight. Carolina will be. But Syracuse hasn't hit that moment yet. And you wonder, you know, how much longer do you go before it's not just a moment, and unfortunately it's a playing trait of a basketball team.
Well, if your defense can't create some easy offense, it puts all the pressure in the world on you on that end. Now, granted, like we said, Syracuse has got a bunch of shooters, but you better make the shot or else. And or else happened against Virginia over the weekend. I think we have a Jim Boeheim quote, too. And, you know, this guy's been around the block. He kind of knows how this game's played. Coach says, our offense is more than good enough. Our defense has been horrendous. It's really 100% responsible for our record. So, that's not just some talking head on radio or television. That's not 32,000 fans screaming it. That's the head coach, and Jim Boeheim knows. So, again, that number, buck 88, defense efficiency, has to get better for the Orange moving forward. It's as simple as that.
Packer and Durham. This is the Packer and Durham podcast.
All right, Wes, we've talked a lot of hoops the first hour and a half of the show. We're going to switch gears on you. We've got the national championship game coming up on Monday night in Indianapolis, a great host city. They always do a great job for Final Fours, and they get a chance to do it for the college football playoff. Movers and shakers are getting together to discuss playoff expansion. We just had the television numbers come out from the national semis on Friday night, and they were down from a year ago when both Clemson and Notre Dame were in it. New Year's Eve's got something to do with it. Two blowout games that were not interesting has something to do with it. But the movers and shakers say, you know what, we're not concerned with the ratings. It's not going to hold us back from moving forward to expand from four until maybe it's eight, maybe it's 12. Who knows what the number's going to be. But I do think it's inevitable that we're going to see expansion with college football.
I agree with you on that. I think the big framework of college football has to be addressed in this. I do find it interesting that a lot of the reporting on this is citing the ACC and the Pac-12 as standing in the way of expansion. And Jim Phillips, I thought, Mark, had been very candid with us in talking about a couple different areas. In fact, one when he was with us at the basement the Friday of the championship game. I think the ACC is for playoff expansion, but it's the larger framework that they want to expand with. It's not just to say, hey, we're going from 8 to 12, but what does that schedule look like? I think that's a fair question to ask, and honestly, it's not one I'm hearing discussed very much by those who cover college football, surprisingly.
Well, I think more folks are looking to point a finger to say, it's their fault, it's his fault. As opposed to, hey, this is a complex issue. I don't think there's anybody, to my opinion, from where I sit, that is against expansion. But there is a process to get there, which have been the issues that, hey, you got to jump over the right hoop and so forth. So to say that somebody's against expansion, I think is inaccurate. I can certainly vouch for Jim Phillips. He sat 2 inches from where I'm sitting right now. And told the world on this network that, hey, we're not against expansion, but there are things that need to be in place for this to work. That is the issue, right? And that thing or things need to be agreed upon by all 11 in the room. Now, I've kidded around before Wes, you could get your 10 best friends and say, hey, where are we going to dinner tonight? And I got news for you. Very seldom will all 11 of you agree, yep, let's go to Joey Jones Steakhouse. I mean, it's hard to get everybody eventually on the same page, because what may work for the ACC maybe doesn't work for the Pac-12 or the SEC, or vice versa, whatever the case may be. Eventually, all the smart people, and they are smart. Now, these are the real movers and shakers and leaders of college sports. It's got nothing to do with the NCAA. They will eventually figure this thing out. But to say that somebody's against expansion, I don't think that's accurate. I don't think that's accurate at all.
No, I'm with you totally on that and agree. Let's kind of use previous years here as our guide, okay? Let's don't look at what would have happened this year. We can if we want to. I mean, we know that if the field were expanded this year, Pittsburgh would have been in the field as the champion of the ACC. So let's go back and look at, like, I don't know, we'll go back 7-8 years here, click off and say, okay, if the field had been expanded to 8 or 12, what would that have meant to the ACC? Well, in the case of 2019, 2018, it would have meant one team and one team only. That would have been Clemson in a 12-team format or in an 8-team format. The years of 14 through 17, though, Packer, very interesting, because that would have meant in one case, 2015, three teams from the ACC would have been in a 12-team format. But I don't know that we've got any kind of rhythm to where the ACC falls in an expanded format just yet.
Well, I mean, we've had four. The number's four. I mean, that's the only thing you can judge on. And until this year, the conference has been in it every single year. So this was a tough year. Obviously, you mentioned Pitt wins the ACC championship, but we don't have anybody in the Final Four. I think, again, this is inevitable that we're going to get to an additional number. And what needs to be discussed amongst the smart folks is, does a conference champion have an automatic bid? Some like it, some don't. Eventually, those 11 smart folks have to agree on that concept. That's part of that process that we keep talking about. It's not against somebody's against expansion, but how do we get there? The most important thing, though, and again, I think that we're going to get expansion with the playoff. The most important thing, though, for this league is how many teams are going to be able to elevate their game to get in the conversation. Clemson has obviously proven that they can do it. Miami's got an uptick with Mario coming in there and all that great stuff. Quarterback's back. You know, Florida State's got to be good. Who else can join the mix? Can Pittsburgh could put back-to-back years now coming up here, coming off an ACC championship? NC State looks like they're primed to maybe knock the door down because they're on the doorstep. North Carolina always gets a bunch of hype, but man, can they follow through and close? I don't know.
Right.
The Virginia Tech, do we get them back to how it was when Beamer Ball had that thing rocking in the early part of the century? The league needs to take care of its business before the country takes care of its business with the playoff. That's the way I kind of look at it. Right now, to be honest with you, yeah, Clemson had the hiccup year, and a hiccup year for them is 10-3, puts things in perspective. I expect Clemson to be in that conversation for the next couple of years for sure, as we talk about what's this snapshot short-term going to look like. Who else can join the fray to be in the conversation? To me, that's the key for the ACC. Whether we're at 4, 8, 12, hey, that'll take care of itself. The ACC needs to take care of itself.
Mark, are you concerned at all about the television numbers right now for the college football playoff and the New Year's Six? Now, the Rose Bowl had a huge television number. Part of this, though, and we've discussed this, a lot of what goes on in that room, once you get past the administrative piece of all this, comes down to the business side of what the new college football playoff will look like, an expanded field of 8, 12, 16, whatever the number is that ultimately they end up on here. Some of that, though, has to go to what the dollars and cents are going to be. And the number fall off this year, especially on New Year's Eve, and I think that was kind of predictable. Call me crazy. I just think that the December 31st date is a tough date for those semifinal games to be played. But in this particular case, did the television numbers concern you at all?
Two things. Number one, the Georgia-Michigan game was the least watched television number of the second semifinal, period. Doesn't matter if the game was on New Year's Eve. Well, not on New Year's Eve. But you know what? The game stunk. Let's be honest. There wasn't anything compelling about that game at all, other than the fact that Georgia put Michigan in a trash can and jumped them. There's two things. When I go to a game, Wes, there's two things that someone will never, ever ask me. Number one, they won't tap me on the shoulder and go, hey, that quarterback out there, do you know what his SAT number was? Do you know what his grade point is? I've never been asked that at a game. You know what else I've never been asked at a game? Hey, this is a really good game. What do you think the television rating is going to be? Fans don't care about that stuff, right? Now, I know you mentioned it's a business, and it is. We work for a company that is absolutely invested in college football, and the more eyeballs, the better. That means more money. And if you want an answer to a question, follow the money. You'll get it. I think there's a lot of people interested in the rights to the college football playoffs. Right now, ESPN basically has cornered the market. There's a lot of folks that believe that one of the reasons there's a slow play going on here amongst the alliance is to get this contract to its end, where all of a sudden there could be more bidders in the deal. Mm-hmm. I think that's accurate. I'll be honest with you. I think the concept is, if more people can have an opportunity to give you money, why would you not take advantage of that? Now, if you're ESPN, you're sitting there going, man, screw that. We want to negotiate a deal now and own this bad boy, right? So depending on which side of the table you're on, I think you probably get a different answer. But from a television standpoint, you know what? Over nearly 17 million people still watch those games on Friday night, and they were two dogs. They were not compelling. They were not interesting. They were not close. They had no drama. But yet 17 million people still watch those games. When you compare that to what you'd normally get with a regular bowl game where, maybe, hey, if you get 2 or 3 million people, that was a great deal. It puts it in perspective. Is it the Super Bowl? No, but it's never going to be the Super Bowl. So there's still a ton of eyeballs and money, Wes, even though the numbers were down from a year ago. And New Year's Eve absolutely had an impact on that. I mean, anytime you've got primetime games New Year's Eve, you can expect there to be a dip. That's natural.
The other part of this that could be the pseudo elephant in the room is, how are you going to, and you've mentioned this, how are you going to incorporate this field? How's this field going to be built? We already have the College Football Playoff Committee that determines the Final Four. They determine a top 25 that starts in early November. How is the rest of that field going to be comprised and constructed? And what values are there going to be? The secondary part of this is, and this kind of relates to the business side of it, if you add games to a college football playoff format, what games are sacrificed in the process? Because some postseason games, probably some of note, may potentially go away or become pieces of the playoff. You know, like we saw this year with the Orange Bowl and the Cotton Bowl. The national championship will probably remain its own entity, like in Indianapolis next Monday night. Indianapolis doesn't have a bowl game during the year. The city of Indianapolis bid on this event, just like they do the Final Four or other great events that they've hosted, Atlanta, so on and so forth. Now comes the question of, how does the construction of that work, and what does that do to impact each individual conference too? Because these conferences have contracts, Pac, as you know, with these bowls, that if they're not involved in the college football playoff semifinal, the ACC champion goes to Miami and plays in the Orange Bowl. I mean, how does that work from a constitutional standpoint? That part of this in the business acumen of the packaging also has to be determined, and that's not being discussed. And here's the other thing, too. And look, here's the other elephant in the room. There are a lot of people in college football that don't necessarily want to see another version of the SEC meetings in Hoover, Alabama when it comes to the college football playoff. A lot of people don't want to see, certainly SEC fans do, but a lot of people don't want to see 4 or 6 teams comprise the 12-team field of the college football playoff from one conference.
Well, I'll be honest with you. Again, this goes back to hosting this show in the afternoon, which I talk about the whole country. I don't care. I mean, from our perspective here in the ACC, we'd love to have more ACC teams in. That's natural, right? Mm-hmm. That's a no-brainer. But when it comes to the championship, I don't care where the teams are from. I mean, we're going to have a pair of SEC teams play on Monday night. If those are the two best teams, and I think they are, what's there to complain about? If you're a college football fan, again, I'm going to come from a perspective of a fan, not wearing an ACC hat or an SEC hat or whatever. If you're a college football fan, what you want in the championship game are the two best teams. I would say that if I followed the NBA, the NFL, Major League Baseball, the WNBA, I mean, give me the two best teams to play for a championship. If the field expands from 4 to 8 or from 4 to 12, awesome. It gives more teams an opportunity, more conferences to feel like they're a part of something. If one particular league happens to have 6 of the 12 teams, well, then everybody else should get better. I mean, that's I've always looked at that, and I've always laughed this week, and oh, I'm sick and tired of hearing watching Alabama-Clemson. I'm tired of watching Alabama-Georgia. Well, here's an idea. Find something else to do. If those are the best teams, that's the game I want to watch as a college football fan. Now, I hope the ACC can elevate their game where Clemson can continue to be a college football playoff member like they have for the most part in 6 of the 8 years. I'd love to see Miami, Florida State, North Carolina, NC State, Pitt, fill in the blank with your favorite ACC team. Be a part of that conversation. The only way you do that is to get better, to invest in college football, facilities, coaching, recruiting, your fan base. Everybody's got to be on board. If you think this is like a part-time job, here's what will happen. You're going to be sitting on the couch watching somebody else throw a party. And so the league has to invest in football, whether we're at 4, 8, 12, 16, 64, whatever number you want to come up with. So I think it's as simple as that. I mean, are there complexities with this conversation when trying to get all 11 to agree? There are. But to say that there is an outlier out there that people are against expansion, I think that's just flat out wrong. I think whoever's coming up with that nonsense needs to get back to the drawing board.
Yep. We'll follow these meetings, the one certainly next week in Indianapolis after the national championship game between the power brokers of college football, see what comes out of that. And we'll keep an eye on it, too, in our visits with Jim Phillips about also how does that impact the long-term situation with the bowl alliances that the ACC has in terms of contractual obligations to try and put teams in games. And by the way, what does it mean to the bowls down the line?
You know, speaking of bowls, and I'll just throw this in here real quick. You know, you mentioned that Georgia and Bama are playing for the national title as they did 4 years ago, coming up on Monday night. Mm-hmm. And Georgia fans hate this, but this is an ACC show. The last time Georgia won the national championship was 1980. In 1980, Georgia ended up beating Notre Dame for the national championship. And that was the Sugar Bowl. There was a grand total of 14 other bowl games. That's it. So we had 15 bowls in 1980. 15. Today, we've got 6,211. And so when you start, it's not that high, but it's close. But we don't have 15, Wes. And that's my point.
Yeah.
It is a different universe. And you know what? Everybody's got their hand in the cookie jar. Our parent company, ESPN, has done a brilliant job creating live television events. The TV numbers have been good. We sit there and talk about the ratings from Friday night. Well, guess what? 17 million people were still watching the game. And they were two drab, boring, drama-less games. Still 17 million were watching. Keep all that in perspective. That's a bunch of eyeballs.
Here's Mark Packer and Wes Durham.
Packer and Durham, we will continue some more football conversation. You know, coaching staffs, we got four newbies, if you will, in the conference, new head football coaches, and everybody's working to put together new staffs. And we've even had some current guys with some openings to fill, Wes. But a lot of folks keeping an eye on what's going on with Coach Cristobal down at Miami.
Yeah, and the latest news is really not a surprise now. I think there may be some people back east surprised by this but when you start looking at the history here, Brian McClendon is the offensive coordinator, and Adam Rittenberg saying Miami's expected to hire him as the co-offensive coordinator and wide receivers coach. It's exactly what he did for Cristobal at Oregon. He was the interim head coach, of course, in the Alamo Bowl ball game last week. He played football at the University of Georgia. He played for Mark Richt at Georgia. And Brian McClendon's a talented, talented guy. And I'm not surprised with this move at all. That keeps the continuity of the structure they had at Oregon. I think Crystal Ball is probably pretty excited about this. I'm sure Brian McClendon is. He's a great guy, by the way. Look forward to visiting with him in the offseason. But this is the headline job offensively for Miami, right? This is the one we were kind of waiting to see how it would go. And when Brian McClendon was the interim head coach at Oregon, I had gotten an early word that I thought he was, that they thought, the person I talked to said he would be the, it would be almost a straight shot to Miami after the ball game. And sure enough, it's expected to happen here officially pretty soon.
Well, and when you've got TVD back there at quarterback, I think there's a lot of guys can X and O, but you better have the dudes. And I think Miami's got the dude at quarterback to make things happen in 22.
Yeah, no question. And I think McClendon understands that. But here's the other thing too, Pac. Think about all the guys they got to go catch the bullets from Tyler Van Dyke, right? I mean, they got players now. I mean, I know they lose Mike Harley and some guys like that, Charleston Rambo, but Miami had receivers. Will Mallory's going to be back at tight end. They had plenty of guys. They're going to be interesting to watch. And there's going to be a ton of love for Miami in the spring and in the run-up to next August and September. But reality of it is that Cristobal is doing, I think, the smart thing here and keeping some of his Oregon infrastructure. And I'm sure we're going to see some familiar faces show up as well on that coaching staff. But this move right here is no surprise to me.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you 100%. As I mentioned, with four new coaching staffs, you're going to see all kinds of movement. But you've also seen some established situations like Dave Clawson's got a hole to fill. Dabo Swinney now with Bates going to Oklahoma has a hole to fill. Yeah. So this is going to be a storyline up and above round two of National Signing Day coming up next month as we kind of prepare and get ready for spring football in the ACC.
The Packer and Durham Podcast.